Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast, your source for policy, rants, and raves, and a safe space for former employees to come on the show and rant about their former employers. I'm Evan Schwartzschauer, your host. On today's show, the sharing economy. Of course, listeners have seen stories about Uber's regulatory battles with New York City, or strikes in Paris, or court decisions in Germany, but today we're not going to talk about the on-the-ground combat in the sharing economy. We're going to talk about the big picture. What is the sharing economy? What does it look like? How is it impacting our economy? Joining me to discuss this is Will Reinhart, Director of Technology and Innovation Policy at the American Action Forum. Will, thank you for coming back on the show, despite my snarky comments about your disgraceful exit from Tech Freedom, which was written about extensively in Washington City paper.
I mean, it's great to know that being the first hire, I think I was the first hire of Tech Freedom, and whenever I come back, I'm greeted with open arms and they allow me to do a podcast, which is oh so nice.
Yeah, I mean, originally you weren't allowed within 100 feet of this building, but I had the restraining order temporarily lifted.
So that's not true for the listeners who are concerned about that, by the way.
All right, so Will, let's start with the basics. I think one of the frustrations for a lot of policy people like yourself is you see, you know, on Twitter and Facebook and, you know, in the news, just commentary about the sharing economy.
Yeah.
And it's not really clear what the people writing these articles mean, what they think they mean, and not everything's the same. So you have companies like Uber and Airbnb, but then you have companies like Etsy, and then you have companies like Thumbtack that we've talked about on the show. And these are not all the same, and they all get lumped
exactly
together. So let's start with the sharing economy. What does that mean to you?
So the sharing economy, I mean, this is obviously an interesting area of discussion. The sharing economy, to me, is kind of been derided, and I think that's because a lot of different types of companies and actions are all put together. So I like to think about it a little differently. I mean, mainly what I'm concerned about is the gig economy, and this is the idea of independent workers, just generally speaking. The idea with the gig economy is that we're trying to understand people who are in these non-traditional jobs. So these include, you know, independent contractors, but it also includes individuals who are doing short-time work or doing temporary work. So the gig economy is something that, you know, contingent workers, sometimes as the census will say, the gig economy has existed for quite some time. So that we kind of know a little bit about, and there's still some major problems and definitions. But what people are really concerned about now is how really Uber and Airbnb are affecting the labor economy, generally speaking. And typically people put these as they heap them both together in this sharing economy, and they're actually different. When you look at Uber, it's actually more of an on-demand platform. You want a taxi ride and you get a taxi ride very, very quickly, or something that's akin to a taxi ride. With Airbnb, it's a little bit different in the sense that it's not necessarily on demand, because individuals don't necessarily have to take your reservation to be in their house. So what you would look at when you look at these two when you look at these two services, many people talk about these as peer-to-peer production. So there's this element of individuals producing some service or some product for another individual, but not necessarily sharing it, because obviously there's money involved and there's exchange involved that makes the entire thing run.
Yeah, so I guess, yeah, peer-to-peer production, that would make sense for companies like Uber and Airbnb. You're mm-hmm. not necessarily sharing something, you are selling it for a fleeting moment. You know,
you're
selling a seat in your car and then driving someone somewhere, or you're renting out your house. And Jared Meyer, who's a research fellow at the Manhattan Institute, he's been on the show several times to talk about the sharing economy, and he likes to point out that this is not some new thing that just arose due to the internet. You have terms like the app-based economy, which can be misleading, because you just mentioned the gig economy, the basic idea that you have workers with alternative work arrangements, independent contracting, that was not invented in 2009 or whenever Uber was invented.
Yeah.
It's really that...
That's good. It was 2009, by the way.
Ah, I guess I have amazing recall.
Which is actually really interesting, because 2009 was exactly the downturn of the market. And that's what's very interesting about Uber as a company, is that Uber came about at exactly the time when you had individuals who were looking for opportunities. And that's kind of the point about Uber, is that I think a lot of people misconstrue what Uber is actually trying to do and what workers and people who are working for Uber actually get out of the arrangement.
So if you have peer-to-peer production, which covers companies like Uber and Airbnb, are there other facets of what has until now been called the sharing economy that are kind of in a different bucket?
What do you mean by that specifically? So
I guess you've got companies like Thumbtack, and we talked about them on the show, where it allows people who already have a career. I'm a plumber. I can reshingle your roof. I have a skill set, a skilled labor, as opposed to Uber and Airbnb, which is relatively unskilled. I mean, I'm not saying that the drivers don't have mad skills, but most people can drive a car. Most people can rent an apartment. It doesn't require some level of training. Whereas Thumbtack is skilled labor. You know, is that different? Would that be still part of like the gig economy? I mean, there's all these different ways of defining this, and there hasn't been a real clarity.
Yes, exactly. And so I would agree with you. Now that you put it in that framing, you're exactly right. I mean, the gig economy includes that, and it's kind of the most expansive term that we would use here. You can drill it down a little bit more and think about the online gig economy, and those use these online platforms.
Right.
And within the online gig economy, you know, Airbnb and Uber are parts of that, but there are other parts of it, which is Thumbtack is a great example. There's also something that goes on with a lot of programmers that most people don't know, but they'll use social networks, social networks and other networking methods in order to actually connect with potential employers. And so they'll do like short-term contracts. They'll write some portion of a code, or they'll do, you know, some web development. And they'll find those individuals through online platforms. So sometimes this happens via LinkedIn. There's been kind of a well-known one in the tech world called WeWork that's been making some headway. And then you also have these kind of like services like Cove and these work sharing services that allow for individuals to connect both online and in physical space in order to do these short-term gigs. So it kind of commingles a lot of these different definitions and makes it a little difficult, obviously, for analysis. But first and foremost, we at least have to have some working basis that the sharing economy, even though we talk about it and use it as this term, it's far more fine-grained when you actually look at these companies than what most people would say.
So let's talk about the controversy. I mean, you have presidential candidates like Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders expressing a lot of concern about the effect on the nature of work and labor that these companies have. You have former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, who critics might just refer to as an outright Luddite because of his position on the sharing economy. But he's talked about things like the share the scraps economy, and that all this is a way for people to scrap up whatever they can that's left after Wall Street destroyed the economy and whatnot, and that people are forced into doing these undignified jobs because they have no other options. I mean, that's one really pessimistic way of looking at it. But there really seems to be this concern that the sharing economy is taking over, that this is like completely revolutionizing everything about work. And I'm not so sure the data back that up. So, Will, kind of give us a sense of how big is the sharing economy? How relevant is it? How much of the economy is really represented by companies like Uber and Airbnb?
So this is actually very difficult to figure out in the data. The census does a little bit of this research, but for the most part, this is done through these special surveys, which don't come out all too often. And so I actually looked with a co-author of mine, Ben Geddes, and we try to determine what's happening in both the traditional gig economy, which there's been some confusion about, and then obviously in this smaller online gig economy, and specifically for Airbnb and Uber.
And for the traditional gig economy, would you just conceptualize that by like, I'm a guy who has a certain skill and I post an ad in a newspaper or I post an ad on Craigslist, the more old school way of finding clients, like I'm a housekeeper or something like that?
Yeah, something along those lines. But these also potentially could include lawyers that are working on their own.
Any type of contract work, really.
A lot of service workers are included in independent contractors. And that's why it's really hard to say, okay, there's obviously clearly individuals who are within the service economy clearly benefit from, you know, having the flexibility. And this is one of the big benefits, obviously, especially for working mothers who obviously need this type of flexibility. But, you know, getting back a little bit more at hand, I mean, when you actually look at the the economy and how much it grew, it seems that the gig workers, and these are a lot of people, these are, again, independent contractors, minimum, you know, minimum people who are also on minimum wage. So it really is a huge spectrum of individuals. But so when you look at this group of individuals, they seem to have added about 30% of all the jobs during the recovery. So when you compare them again across the traditional, like, so the traditional full-time employees and part-time employees. So I'm sorry, I said earlier before, people who are on minimum wage, typically individuals who are on minimum wage are actually part-time employees of some sort. Right, so those individuals wouldn't actually be within the gig economy.
So the important distinction is basically just independent contractors versus your typical 9-to-5 job with benefits, whether that's full-time or part-time.
Exactly. And so when you look at that, when you compare those two types of workers, independent contractors with these full-time workers, you see that again, they actually increased pretty dramatically. They increased a lot more, and especially workers in this group grew from about, you know, they grew by about 8% to about 15% from 2002 to 2014.
So that would kind of belie the notion that this thing is taking over and that it's completely consuming our economy, and, you know, the Robert Reich doomsday scenario where we're all going to be trapped in these gigs that don't offer any sort of job security, that don't allow you to have a family, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and when you look at it also across countries, which is actually very interesting, the United States again has among the least amount of individuals who are in these independent contractors or this independent contingent work, as sometimes it's called, or in the gig economy. So when you look at the Western world and you actually compare the United States to most other countries, it's by far, it has the most amount of full-time employees, even still right now to today.
Huh. Well, that's, I guess, really counterintuitive. I mean, a lot of these companies that are so big, like Uber and Airbnb, they originated here. And clearly Americans enjoy, I guess, more internet access than most countries. So I guess it's kind of ironic that the birthplace of these companies and the birthplace of the online gig economy arguably doesn't have as many gig workers as other countries. We still rely heavily on the traditional model of employment, which is more job security, more benefits, more 9-to-5-ish, sitting at a desk type work.
Yeah, bingo. And when you actually look at some of the countries that have had the biggest backlashes to Uber, I mean, France is a great example. France actually has a fairly low percentage of individuals. I mean, it is relatively within the region higher, but it still has a relatively high amount of individuals, rather, that are technically considered independent contractors. So it's interesting when you look at the United States as compared to some of the countries that have actually had a pretty big reaction to Uber specifically. And I think that's probably related more to the industry itself rather than specifically the idea that the gig economy or the online gig economy is really going to destroy everything.
So a relatively small percentage of people maybe are using these online platforms compared to the whole workforce. But what sort of impact in general is the gig economy having on our economy as a whole? I mean, is this really, is everyone benefiting from this, not just people who take and drive Ubers, but are other people benefiting from this explosion of innovation and companies being worth $40 billion after a few years? I mean, what sort of effect is this having?
Yeah, so again, we looked at, my co-author and I, Ben, we actually looked at some of this data, and the most interesting one is actually this kind of unknown census survey that's called non-employer firms. So these are the firms that essentially have no employees. And when you look at these types of firms, you know, what we did is we just looked at the change from 2009 when you had the increase in these peer-to-peer platforms. And specifically looking within the taxi cab section, we saw that there was an increase from 2009 to 2013, the last good year that we could get data. We found an increase of about 22,000 jobs in the sector, 22,000 different firms. So it's not exactly, you know, correlated, but we assume that about 22,000 individuals had a job in the space as compared to what probably should have occurred. So there were about 22,000 more individuals employed under this regime, and that included about, or, you know, gave to individuals about a half a billion dollars worth of of money. I mean, there's some interesting problems with looking at this over time, which I'm actually conducting some research right now to try to really drill down and figure out what's going on here. But when you look at individuals who are engaged in this, it's pretty clear that they're probably benefiting. I mean, the JP Morgan recently had a study and they looked at their customers who are actually engaged in one of these platforms, and they looked at, you know, before and after their engagement with the platform, and they were able to find that the individuals can make up to 15% more in their total income for a given year because they're engaged in these online gig activities, which I think is really important because we haven't really had really good data, and that's what a lot of people are working off of, is this very ad hoc kind of anecdotal data from individuals who, you know, potentially may have gotten thrown out of work and are doing Uber as kind of a last resort, which is unfortunate and does occur, but it's by far, it's not really what happens when you look at the vast majority of individuals. Less than 10% of individuals who actually come specifically to Uber did so because they didn't have a job beforehand.
Or, yeah, I mean, the vast majority of the drivers are doing this part-time.
And yes, exactly.
And I don't think
over two-thirds are.
Right, and these companies aren't necessarily advertising as like, oh, we can replace your full-time job. I mean, I've never seen an ad from Uber that says, drive for Uber and quit your full-time salary job with benefits. I mean, if you're worried about deceptive marketing, the evidence isn't necessarily there. But we've hit on a couple of things. 2009 correlated, you know, Uber's rise correlated with the economic downturn, people looking for alternative methods of making money. Why is the gig economy on the rise now, and where do you see it going from here on out?
So I'm interested to see what happens when we have better data. I think that obviously a lot of the work that I've done has ended in 2013, and I'm actually really interested to see what comes out, and it should be coming out in another month or so. But what we've seen obviously is that individuals engage in these activities because they want supplemental income. There is, for example, the Freelancers Union, which is organized by, I think it's President Sarah Horowitz, and she actually pointed out that a very large percentage of her members of these freelancers are actually women who want the flexibility that comes with these types of work arrangements. So flexibility is a big thing that constantly comes up again and again and again. And in fact, when you look at the actual options that some individuals have in order to make additional income, this is the thing that continues to drive them to work for these online gig economies, and, you know, working for TaskRabbit, working for Uber, is that they have the ability to do other things. They're not necessarily controlled by a company. Like, they may be if they have to have certain working hours. So for example, a lot of individuals have to do what are called clopens. So you have to close a store, and then you have to open the store the next morning. Well, that doesn't really lend itself well to children. You know, it doesn't lend itself well if you're trying to take care of somebody who's elderly. So the flexibility, of course, that these work arrangements actually give individuals is a huge thing. Again, supplemental income is a big one. Flexibility is a big one. And I think the other part of it really is that the individuals want something that's more hands-on. The physicality of it actually is something that whenever I talk to an Uber driver, whenever you talk to individuals who are doing this kind of thing, is that they crave this kind of physicality that they often can't get from their normal 9-to-5 jobs as well.
Right. And as we look and see where this is going, I mean, it's worth pointing out that, you know, you're hungry for more data. We all want to see more data and have more to work off of and how to interpret this. But what's interesting is that a lack of clear data has not stopped politicians from weighing in. It hasn't stopped, the Federal Trade Commission from looking at sharing economy specific regulations. And as we discussed on this show, it's not even clear what the sharing economy is, depending on who you ask. So the idea that they would make specific regulations for that is interesting. Would it apply to people who only use Thumbtack for plumbing, or would it apply to someone who is a plumber, but all of his clientele come through word of mouth? I mean, really, this this calls for one of the themes we talk about at Tech Freedom, regulatory humility. We have no idea how this is going to shake out. This is a fairly new situation. It's kind of bringing out of the shadows a part of our economy that's always existed. It's making it easier to find customers if you have a skill or unskilled, but you have an asset like a job or a car or a house. But really, this calls for stepping back and looking at the data, seeing what we can find before we rush into any sort of regulatory regime.
The one thing I would close with, I know we're almost at time here, but the one thing I would also mention is that there has been some preliminary and really good evidence to suggest that individuals who actually engage in these types of activities have much higher ownership rates. So instead of renting a house, they actually are more likely to buy a house or are more likely to own a house. And so when you think about this, and this has been something else that's been continually mentioned in Airbnb, is that it forces out people within the rental market. Because you have some companies that just want to, use these as short-term hotels. But when you think about some of the places, especially when it comes to Airbnb, that have had the most tension when it comes to the regulatory side, it's been in places like San Francisco and places like New York, where there is this high cost of living that does get translated into the willingness for individuals to board out, to have people stay there so they can stay within their apartment or they can stay within their home. So this balance between the costs that everyone talks about, but also the real benefits that exist and are accrued to individuals who are engaged in the economy, I think that really needs to be teased out. And I hope in the future that there's better work, because a lot of what I've seen so far is just really shoddy analysis.
Yeah, I mean, it might just be that it's too soon to tell.
Yeah.
But that's it for today's show. My guest has been Will Reinhart, Director of Technology and Innovation Policy at American Action Forum. Will, thanks for coming back on the show, despite my poor treatment of you in general when we're in public.
Thanks, Evan.
Follow us on Twitter at Tech Freedom or on Facebook.com/Tech Freedom. Find this podcast in the iTunes Store or on your favorite podcast app. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review. It will help others find the show. Thank you for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.